It's religion today, it's ideology today, and our secularist friends also have a faith.
Some kind of Disneyland fantasy.
I know how this is going to get heard in the secular world.
Where the pseudo-Christian masks are off.
That's nonsense, ladies and gentlemen.
Apologetics isn't just about giving answers to other people's questions. It's also about learning to question other people's answers or even question the question itself.
In a Christian worldview.
Quantum of Solace, number 106, Easter 2017. And I think we begin with what in one sense is somber news, and yet in another sense is just incredible. And that is the death of 41 Coptic Christians in Egypt in a bomb planted, or bombs planted by ISIS as they were worshipping. Now, there are lots of things that one can say about this. I myself am just astounded at how little coverage this did get in our press, who seem obsessed with certain issues and not others. But we came across this wonderful sermon from a Coptic priest who we'll put a link to on the website. But for example, he speaks to the congregation and he says, he prays for those who planted the bomb. Let me just give you one quote. "I am embarrassed to say at the beginning of Holy Week that the church, though she is in pain, rejoices because today I don't know what the final count is. They said 40-something, and of course many people in the hospitals will catch up to them. All of these are crowns. They are rejoicing with God, and they will attend the resurrection up there, and they are praying for us. The rest is on us." It is quite an extraordinary sermon and quite a great reaction, and it does remind us, for Christians, that death is not the end. But we need to remember Christians in the Middle East who are really suffering. The latest statistics that I have seen says the number of Christians in the Middle East has gone down from 15% of the population to 5%. And I just do wonder where the outrage is against that. And then that brings us, of course, to Syria and to what has gone on. Now, in fact, all the stories that we're going to look at this week, they do reflect a somewhat depressing view of the world. It's interesting. I was phoned up by the Mail on Sunday and asked if I would write their Easter piece, which I intend to do. And the journalist said, "Now, with all that's going on in the world, maybe something about hope." And I thought it was very interesting being asked that by a secular journalist. And again, I will put a link to that on my own blog if you want to see that article, if you don't get the Mail on Sunday. Well, I think the Scottish Mail on Sunday even. But let's come back to Syria and bombing Syria. Now, President Trump has changed his mind. He once argued that bombing Syria would be a foolish thing to do. And then there was the gassing of these adults and children. And there are all kinds of questions there. You know, did it involve the Russians? Whether it was actually the Syrian government? Whether it was a rogue element? I mean, I have all kinds of questions, because given that he was winning, why would he do something like that? But also, what is going to happen next? And, you know, there's lots of interesting things about chemical weapons. Do you know that it was the British who first used chemical weapons in the Middle East, with Winston Churchill in the 1920s in Iraq? And the Americans have also used chemical weapons. What do you think napalm was in Vietnam? So why this particular horror about chemical weapons? Because it appears so indiscriminate. And yet, I think a bomb's pretty indiscriminate. The mass bombing of Dresden and so on. And I do think that there are just so many difficulties in all of this. Whether bombing actually solves anything at all. And let's just stay with this connection. Let's come forward to Libya.
Africans trying to reach Europe are being sold by their captors in slave markets in Libya, according to the International Organization for Migration.
This is almost unbelievable.
It says hundreds of young sub-Saharan African men have been caught up in this modern slavery, women being brought by private Libyan clients and brought to homes where they're forced to be sex slaves.
There are now slave markets in Libya, with refugees who are coming from Niger and elsewhere, and who don't make it across the Mediterranean, who are then being sold into slavery.
It's really difficult because, as you suggested at the top, the place is run by militias effectively. There's no real governance. It's a free-for-all where the gun is king. And regular Libyans, normal people, are going and buying migrants so they can kind of get their house painted or have their agriculture, have their fields dug, this kind of thing.
The BBC had a report on Thursday about this. And one of the reporters simply said this.
Sorry, I just wondered if you can do anything to actually educate these people about the miseries that might lie ahead to perhaps stop them leaving their homes in the first instance.
Well, that's the challenge. I mean, that's one thing which we're trying to do, which is to, use journalists, in effect, to interview the migrants before they go home, the 200 or 300 a week that we send home, and capture their stories in their own language, and put it on their own Facebook. Everyone, believe it or not, they're all on Facebook and social media. Put it on their own pages, and then get it back on their local radio stations when they get back home, to their little FM and community radio stations, to try and, because they don't believe, government statements, they don't believe international organizations, and it's hard to blame them. But hopefully they'll believe the kind of credibility of a returning migrant who's been through the mill. Women are being raped, enslaved, men are being abused, many are murdered. Hopefully this message will get through.
We are trying to discourage them from coming to be refugees. Now, there you see the complexity and the difficulty of someone like Angela Merkel saying all are welcome, which sounds wonderful, but if it encourages this, we have ended up, because of Britain and others bombing Gaddafi, and because of encouraging refugees to come, we have ended up with slave markets in Libya and thousands drowning in the Mediterranean. In that sense, life is incredibly complex.
This is very much the fruit of what was left after Gaddafi was bombed out of office and eventually killed.
But just in case you think, well, come on, reintroduction of slavery, you're joking. Well, again, we've said this many times, but there was also a report in the newspaper today that the potential for sex trafficking in Scotland has enormously increased in this past year. And if you think about our attitudes to sex and our attitudes to work and our attitudes towards money and the removal of Christianity from our country, we're going to end up with some kind of slavery. Here's another kind.
I had no idea what I was getting into. He took me into his living room, got me drinks, and then after that it was straight upstairs and go for it. He would do what he wanted to do forcefully, and I just sort of, went along with it.
In England, in fact in the UK, it is legal at the moment for a landlord to advertise sex for rent.
There's a girl staying here now who's done the same, two or three times a week, basically. It's a very easy-going house.
Just pause and think about this for a minute. There are people who are legally advertising, you can stay in my house if I can have sex with you whenever I want.
I was thinking once a week, something like that. I'm happy as long as there's sex involved.
Sorry, but what is that but slavery? Now, some people are arguing, oh, but that's something consensual that they agreed to. I'm sorry. It's prostitution and it's slavery.
Personally, I was under quite a bit of pressure to keep him happy. Because if they're not happy with you, then anything could happen.
We've said before here, this is what's going on in our culture. People are prostituting themselves. In this case, they're prostituting themselves for accommodation.
They could basically just come over to you and say, I want sex now, and you really don't have much of a choice because you know it's their home and you want to just keep that place.
Well done to the Labour MP who's trying to make it illegal, and I hope he succeeds. It's unbelievable that it is legal.
There is an added onus on the owners of these platforms to root this out and to deal with it. And I'm being very explicit, because if they don't stand up to this and then accept their responsibility, I will be pushing for legislation to do it for them.
And let's keep going. The Scottish government and the UK government are doing this for England on a trial basis, and doubtless it will come. It's also being done in Australia. NHS Scotland are to fund a game-changer PrEP HIV drug. Now, I began to look into this a little bit because what puzzled me was in all the news reports, nobody said who it was for. I mean, it all sounds wonderful. It dramatically reduces the chance of being infected with HIV. Isn't that a good thing? Yes, of course it is. Preventing HIV deaths, isn't that a good thing? Yes, of course it is. Who's it for? It is not a drug for people who've got HIV. In fact, currently, people who've got HIV can receive it. This is to be given to prevent HIV. So, will everyone in Scotland get it? No. There are 5 million people here, and at a cost of around £5,000 to £6,000 per year, it would bankrupt the country. So that's not going to happen. So it's not everyone. Okay, so who is it for? Well, when I read the report on which it's based, it absolutely no surprise to me that no journalist covered this at all, and no politician. The politicians tweeted, yes, it's wonderful that we're doing this. But this is who this drug is for. It's about, they reckon, the report reckons between 1,000 and 2,000 people will get it. It is for men who are homosexuals, not all homosexuals. Homosexuals are meant to be around 1% of the population in Scotland. But it's for the tiny minority of those who engage in promiscuous, I'm not even going to any detail here because it's quite specific, promiscuous sex with other men with more than two partners during a year without condoms. Now, we are constantly told we have to go into our schools and tell children to wear condoms. This is a safety thing and so on. And what's going on here? What's going on is that the state, in other words, you and I, our tax money is being used to encourage and fund sexual behavior, which as well as being immoral, is dangerous in many different ways. It's not just HIV that people catch through homosexual promiscuous behavior. Now, again, let me stress here, we're not talking about homosexuals in general. We're talking about this small group, around 5%, who insist on disobeying, disregarding all the health advice. And we're going to end up paying £10 million per year in order to fund that kind of lifestyle. So, how does this work out? Let me ask you something. There are far more people who die because they don't wear cycling helmets. And there are far more people who die because of smoking. So, should the NHS purchase cycling helmets for all cyclists? Should the taxpayer pay for vaping for every smoker? And we can think of numerous other things as well. Now, most people would say no. So why this particular thing? And what makes it even worse is this. That £10 million doesn't come out of thin air. It comes from the NHS budget. And it means that my local NHS board, who are in considerable difficulty financially, are going to have to take money from something else. They're not getting new money. So in order to fund a preventative drug, which will unquestionably encourage people to live a riskier lifestyle, we are going to take money from people who are ill, or we at least are going to take treatment away from people who are ill. How does that make any sense? But that is the twisted and sick and perverted and inverted world in which we live. And the fact that there has been no critical analysis of this whatsoever indicates both the intellectual vacuity of our society, the cowardice, and the perverse immorality. I'm sorry, I'm going to keep going because we are going to come to the good news. Don't worry, there is good news. This is why Christ came, by the way. He didn't come into a world that was he came into a world that was occupied by Romans who went around slaughtering people. He came into a world where there was slavery and where there was child prostitution and all these things. And that's the world that we're in. Let's just continue with this. This is Britain Today. There was complaint about £250,000 being given to the pro-life charity Life because of their work in a women's refuge. Now, it wasn't even advocating against abortion. Where is the complaint as a pro-choice activist is handed £500,000 of taxpayers' money to write a book on abortion and to promote it in schools. The Arts and Humanities, oh my goodness, what a misnamed group. The Arts and Humanities Research Council have given £512,000 to Professor Sally Sheldon to write a biographical study of the 1967 Abortion Act. Now, this lady, a law professor at the University of Kent, was one of the architects of the private member's bill to be allow abortion to be carried out without legal restrictions for any reason up to birth. And she's been given £500,000 of our money to write propaganda for abortion. Seriously? We say you couldn't make this up. We're not making it up. It is unbelievable. And where is the challenge to this? You know, when there's so many needs, and this is what we've come to. And you think, each week we say, okay, we must have reached the bottom. No, we haven't. For those of a more sensitive disposition, you need to be really careful with this next one. But the New York Times did an interview with Peter Singer, who we have mentioned several times on this. He's a utilitarian philosopher who once argued that a pig or a chimpanzee had more rights than a disabled child. Well, Singer's gone even further. He's defended somebody who's accused of sexual abuse against a disabled person on the grounds that because they weren't able to give consent, then it's not harmful. If we assume, he says, that he is profoundly cognitively impaired, we should concede that he cannot understand the normal significance of sexual relations between persons or the meaning and significance of sexual violation. These are, after all, difficult to articulate even for persons of normal cognitive capacity. In that case, he is incapable of giving or withholding informed consent to sexual relations. Indeed, he may lack the concept of consent altogether. This does not exclude the possibility that he was wronged, and he names by Stubblefield the man involved, but it makes less clear what the nature of the wrong might be. It seems reasonable to assume that the experience was pleasurable to him, for even if he is cognitively impaired, he was capable of struggling to resist. You did just hear that. You heard a professor of philosophy at Princeton University arguing that because someone is mentally and physically disabled, that they can't be sexually abused because they don't know what it is to give consent. They are, in effect, an object to be used. That's the hell that we're heading towards. And I'll keep going because you can't. This is unbelievable. We've said it. The transgender and the 51 genders or a million genders or whatever it is going to lead to the end of women's sport and all this wonderful stuff about having 50-50 on boards between men and women. If there are no men and women, then of course, and if you can just change by signing a thing, then it's all irrelevant. Oh, no. They said, don't be daft. That's never going to happen. Well, what about the MTV and TV Awards? They've scrapped gender-specific categories after billion star Aisha Kate Dillon raised the issue. Which category did she want to be in as she classifies as non-binary? So, what's going to go? Best actor? Best actress? Probably. It is going to be just an incredible thing. How can you have women's sport if there are no women? How can you have men's sport if there are no men? We're all binary. We all change over. It doesn't matter. Even worse, you think, those are the maddest things that you can come up with. No, I think this is the maddest thing that I could come up with. Even more special. And that is that, sorry, I should not be, I should not be laughing, but you think, what? No, nobody could seriously argue this. There is an argument that is being used that breastfeeding should not be encouraged. Why? Because it reinforces gender stereotypes. I'm sorry. It reinforces gender stereotypes. It let people think that biology matters, male and female.
I've been quiet, so I'm losing it.
No, that, you just, you know, breastfeeding is unnatural. Let me, no, seriously. This is from the medical journal Pediatrics. A paper argues that promoting breastfeeding as a natural alternative to formulas is wrong because it really doesn't help the cultural revolution. What it says is promoting breastfeeding as natural may be ethically problematic, and even more troubling, it may bolster this belief that natural approaches are presumptively healthier. This may ultimately challenge public health's aims in other contexts, particularly childhood vaccination. Listen to this. This is an incredible statement. Coupling nature with motherhood, however, can inadvertently support biologically deterministic arguments about the roles of men and women in the family. For example, that women should be the primary caretakers of children. Referencing the natural, in brackets, inverted commas rather, in breastfeeding promotion then may inadvertently endorse a controversial set of values about family life and gender roles, which would be ethically inappropriate. The next time I see a woman breastfeeding in a restaurant, I'm going to go up to her and say, excuse me, but do you realize that you're reinforcing gender stereotyping? Seriously? This is not spoof. This is not April the 1st. This is the mad, mad world of the modern intellectual liberal. By the way, that came from Rod Dreher, who I find a fascinating writer, and he's got this wonderful book called The Benedict Option, which I don't agree with. I've written a lengthy, lengthy review of, but some fantastic ideas in it, and he's a very good cultural critic. And as it happens, he's in this weekend Spectator. So there you go. Solas, we're ahead of the times. We're even ahead of the Spectator. So, anyway, maybe the universities are not the problem. Maybe they'll help us. So let's just have some university news. Well, how about that students are being told at the University of Hull that if they fail to use gender-sensitive language, they will be marked down. Yep, that's it. You need to be aware of the powerful and symbolic nature of language, says the guidelines, and use gender-sensitive formulations. Failure to use gender-sensitive language will impact your mark. But what they're saying is they're advising students not to use he or him as a default pronoun, setting he or she or they. But Cardiff Metropolitan University has a guide to inclusive language, which gives gender-neutral alternatives for 34 words or phrases. Things like forefathers, best man for the job, man hour should be avoided in order, quote, to promote an atmosphere in which all students feel valued. Ah, so maybe these universities are not going to be helping us here. In fact, they are the problem, because our old friend we've spoken about before, and this is unbelievable what is happening to him, and that is Dr. Jordan Peterson, who's one of the top researchers in the world, has had a federal research grant application denied for the first time in his long and distinguished academic career. And basically what they're doing is they're shutting him out. You get this circular argument. Research says that. But if you don't give the research that the political liberals want, you won't get the funding, so you can't do the research. So the bubble continues. Now, this is getting worse in another sense. I want to bring this back to my own country, to Scotland, because I am increasingly concerned at the authoritarian tendencies of our government. And I don't care the political party. For me, Tory, Labour, Liberal, Socialist, Green, Nationalist, doesn't matter. But when a government becomes authoritarian, then we're in real trouble. And here we are at universities. The Scottish government have given guidelines to Scottish universities, to the Scottish Funding Council, calling on the Scottish Funding Council to ensure activities in research, innovation and teaching, quote, fully align with and support the government's policy ambitions. So the government's going to fund universities, but it's going to tell universities what to teach and what to research. They have to fully align with and support the government's policy ambitions. I'm sorry, but therein lies the end of academic freedom. And I'll say it again. Once you lose religious freedom, you're going to lose every other freedom, including freedom of the press.
Now, we're going to be doing two things, really, through this series. We're going to be getting to know, getting to appreciate, getting inside the skin and head of some great Christian thinkers. Men like William Tyndale, Richard Sibbes, Thomas Goodwin, and particularly John Owen.
All right. Oh, so gloomy. What do we need? And when do we need it? Well, what do we need? What we need is another Reformation. Speaking of which, just want to put a link to Mike Reeves, who's got this wonderful series for the Christian Institute on Tyndale, John Owen, the English Reformers, and so on. Well worth going listening to. And in this year of the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, maybe it's about time we got reacquainted. We certainly need a new Reformation.
Now, just one little question before we get going. Why the English Reformation and not the British Reformation? Is this just an Englishman being fussy? Well, no. It's that for the bulk of our period, for a good half of it at least, we'll look at Scotland briefly, but Scotland and England were separate nations. They were quite distinct. They were separate kingdoms. And quite simply, Scotland has a very different story. It had a very different Reformation. It's a different story for another time.
In a world of darkness, in a world of confusion, in a post-truth world of alternative facts, I'm simply going to point to the one who said, I am the truth, and the one who said, I am the light. And if you want to know if that's true, then just think about what happened at Easter. He was declared with power to be the Son of God by his resurrection from the dead. The resurrection changes everything. It means that Christ is who he says it was, says he was. It means that everything he said is true. It means that Christians can be like our Egyptian brother right at the beginning. They can kill us, but they can't take the soul. We have this fabulous news. I think the world, as I've read this stuff and we commented on it, it's darkness, it's madness, it's insane. The notion that people would even dare to put that breastfeeding is unnatural, or that you can stay in someone's house if you pay them rent by having sex with them, or that slavery has come back, or that taxpayers' money is used to fund and promote killing children in the womb, or that universities are told by government what they should and shouldn't teach. All these things indicates a world that is in increasing despair. But that's why Christ came. He came to give us hope. He came to cause renewal. And I hope that we will see this in our generation. So as I look at the world, I am profoundly disturbed. And as I look at Christ, I am profoundly thankful. Happy Easter.
Yo. We're part of a culture that really loves to hate us. Every chance they attempt to isolate and debate us. It's not that they don't like us, it's just they don't like God in us. It's common knowledge, and oddly enough, it makes a lot of sense to a lot of us. We completely understand because we used to occupy the same space and lived in a similar type state until we tasted of God's grace. So we continue loving this world that so easily rejects us and passionately press past the lack of their cultural acceptance. And as if there weren't enough problems for us gaining influence, we keep fighting over the issue of what's too worldly of a Christian to make a difference. So no matter how you paint it or politically campaign it, whether you water it down and drain it, it's really all the same, ain't it? It's the same frustration, same constant segregation. Christians living like aliens trying to relate with citizens of a different nation. What always makes for a better presentation than bark and bite is a proper understanding of living life filled with salt and light. So we walk this fine line of walking in light of God's kindness and live with a sense of worldliness without the fear of compromising. Loving God and neighbor until Christ comes to split the sky or die in this society, hailing Jesus as Messiah. Yep.